You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Journalist and television historian Jennifer Cation Armstrong returns to the show this week. She's the author of Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted and All the Brilliant Minds Who Made the Mary Tyler Moore Show a Classic, Seinfeldia, How a Show About Nothing Changed Everything, and her newest book, Sex in the City and Us, How Four Single Women Changed the Way We Think, Live, and Love. Jennifer Cation Armstrong, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
I love the book. It's great. And I love all your books. The books that you've written about TV shows, they're not just appreciations. They're about how these particular shows changed the landscape of television and how they affected our culture. And in this book, Jennifer Cation Armstrong, The Sex in the City and Us, there's a person in the book that wasn't really present in your other books, and that person is you.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, so you're not writing about, you know, a time in the nation's past or in my past like you did with the Mary Tyler Moore Show, but about your own personal history with Sex in the City, at least a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just feel like there's something about this show, first of all, in general, that feels like, you know, throughout the book, I include some anecdotes from, you know, regular people, for lack of a better way of saying that, from people who were just fans of the show, and their lives were changed in big and small ways by watching it, whether they were, you know, inspired to pursue a career in fashion or try new sex things or any of these things. You know, I have kind of these sprinkled throughout, because this show, more than definitely the others that I have written about and more than most other shows, really, like, actually affected people's everyday lives. You know, people started going to brunch, people started ordering Cosmos, and I felt like if I was going to include other people's stories about that, I wanted to include my own, and I happen to have one, which is the other important part of this, of course. The very first line of the book is, I left my fiancé for Sex in the City, and of course, I like to say the caveat that, you know, I'm not an idiot, I didn't just, like, blindly do things because a television show was doing them, but it really gave me this sort of vision for what my life could be like beyond what I thought it was going to be. So I had thought, like, you know, I grew up in the Midwest, I was engaged to my college sweetheart, and kind of figured, like, okay, I'm going to do this, and, you know, we're going to get a house in the suburbs and have some kids. And right around the time that I was watching the show and we had just moved to the New York City area, so all of that kind of really came together in this new way for me, and I kind of went, like, oh, I could be having, I really, it felt suddenly so accessible to me that I could actually have this life, and that I hadn't really gotten to do it yet, you know, because I had been with the same man since college. So it was sort of my inspiration for being able to leave him and go forth on my own in the city.
And so, and also you kind of mimicked the early Sex in the City thing, where there's interviews with people on the street about their sex habits and so forth.
That's true. I hadn't totally thought about it that way. It was more just that I was felt so determined between my own story and honestly the first one that inspired me to sprinkle those stories throughout too was that my sister started telling me, and she's in the book, she started telling me how, you know, she's a costumer on the show Chicago Med. And she felt like she was genuinely inspired to go into fashion because of Sex in the City. And she really looked up to Patricia Field, who did the really revolutionary costuming on Sex in the City. And so, and she had this great story about how she would sneak downstairs to watch it when she was a teenager, not because she wanted to see the sex stuff that my mom didn't want her to see. She didn't care about that. She wanted to see the fashion because at that time, especially, there was very little internet. You know, she basically said, you know, there was Vogue and there was Sex in the City in terms of telling somebody, a girl, a teenage girl in Homer Glen, Illinois, what was going on in fashion. This is all she had. And so I thought, like, wow, that's so interesting and specific and great. And then once I started asking around, there were, of course, plenty of stories beyond the typical, like, of course, there were the people who moved to New York seeking their, you know, Carrie Bradshaw lives, but there were so many more things that just inspired people to do and try and, you know, some good, some maybe not so good. Maybe we didn't need so many Cosmos, but, you know, it really was kind of an inspiration in that way. And I don't think, you know, you just, like, I don't think anyone looked at Seinfeld and went like, ooh, what can I do to be more like these four people? You know, I'm going to go like have muffin tops or something. Like, it wasn't that kind of show. And Sex and the City was very unique in that way.
People have often compared Girls to Sex and the City, but the fashion mm-hmm. aspect, I mean, Girls is more like what not to wear than it is. Like...
I mean, so what I say about Girls, I think Girls is so interesting. I mean, in a number of ways, but in terms of Sex and the City, I always say that Girls is a show about young women who grew up watching Sex and the City and are now kind of trying it out and finding out that life isn't, that real life isn't like Sex and the City. And I always loved the anti-Sex and the City kind of mode of Girls in terms of, you know, they were a lot closer to what, especially your 20s in New York, and really life in general in New York would be like, you know, it's Sex and the City was what they say is aspirational. You know, it was a slightly unrealistic idea, but I think it was purposely that way to kind of make them seem glamorous and, you know, make us want to do the things that they're doing.
Well, the part in the book where you talk about yourself was my favorite part because, and I mean, you and I have talked here a number of times, and I've read all your books, and I don't know anything about you. And now you now you told us some things. So when you say you're from the Midwest, be more specific. Where in the Midwest?
Yeah, I'm from Homer Glen, Illinois, which is in the southwest suburbs of Chicago. But it's a little one, so it's not you know, it's like kind of near Joliet, which is how most people, near the prison in Joliet.
Nice.
That kind of gives people, you know, an idea. But, you know, I'd say a lot of the suburbs of Chicago are tend to be pretty sort of like traditional-ish, you know, like Chicago, of course, is a big city and it's known as being, you know, it's a blue state, it's a blue city, liberal in general, but like the suburbs are a little different. You know, they're a little more conservative. And like I said, just traditional, and we really grew up kind of in a very traditional home, you know, mom stayed home, dad went to work, and, you know, that was sort of my vision for what my life was going to be like until really I got to New York City. I mean, you know, I had inklings of it before I got to New York, and I knew I wanted to have a job. For instance, I was always very ambitious, but... It's still like this idea of getting out of the suburbs and getting out of the, you know, marriage to your college sweetheart and 2.5 kids and all that. That was a big deal for me.
Had you started writing when you were living there?
Oh, yeah. I assume that this is true of most writers. I could be wrong, but, you know, it's just like I was writing as soon as I could. You know what I mean? It was just... Uh-huh. I always say it was around 8. That's like my memory, but who knows? I'm sure I was doing stuff even before that, and I was always being creative. Like, I used to write plays that I would make all my friends do in the garage, you know, that sort of thing. So, and my mom gave me her old typewriter fairly early, and I started writing my little plays and my short stories and stuff pretty soon after that.
And did you, were you a writing major in college? And where did you go to college?
Journalism. I went to Northwestern.
And so how did that lead you to Entertainment Weekly? I think Entertainment Weekly is when I first heard your name.
Yeah, and that's like, to me, that's like the beginning of my career, really, you know, in my head. And it's that thing where I think everybody has a job where it's all of a sudden the magic happens and it's the thing that gave me everything else that came after. But I did spend, I mean, it felt so much longer, but I guess it was like 5 years right after college as a, local newspaper reporter in Southern California. And then very briefly, I went back to Chicago, and that was kind of the last newspaper job I had. I kind of already knew I didn't want to do that. It's a really hard job. I'm glad someone does it, but I did not like writing, you know, I was writing 3 and 4 stories a day, especially at my first job. This is very typical, like going to the city council meetings and checking the police blotter and the whole thing. And it taught me so much. I'm really glad I did it. But it was so miserable. I mean, I was just a stress ball the whole time because, you know, we were competing with bigger papers. You know, I was expected to be the first on every story, and it was all very stressful. And it wasn't, you know, I like to write books. I didn't want to be writing 4 stories a day. You know, I like taking a year or two to write something. So, I did that, and then, like, I had a weird transitional time where I knew I didn't want to do that, but I didn't know what to do. So I was actually the managing editor of a group of home decor trade magazines in the Chicago suburbs, which was a very leisurely job and allowed me to spend most of my work time. I'm sorry to say this is not a very nice thing to do, but didn't have a lot to do there, so I would spend most of my work days freelancing for, at the time, I was freelancing for essentially VH1.com, writing about music and stuff like that, and kind of like building up clips in entertainment, which is what I had wanted to write about. And so that kind of did end up, that's not precisely what led me directly to Entertainment Weekly, but when my ex and I moved to the New York City area, I was able to look for jobs and kind of saw that as a reset. And I really wanted to be in consumer magazines, national magazines, and eventually was lucky enough to end up at Entertainment Weekly as an assistant and worked my way up there for about 10 years.
So what made you guys decide to move to New York? You were seeking something like Entertainment Weekly?
Sort of. Yeah, there was a very specific, actually, that was part of it. It's like, he had finished grad school in Chicago, and we had a chance to do whatever we wanted, kind of, at that moment. You know, we had a chance to choose. And I had actually, relevant to this conversation, I'd actually had this moment where I got into grad school in San Francisco. So I actually had to choose, it's a very sex in the city, too. I had to choose between going to New York with my ex or going to grad school in San Francisco. And I decided, he got a job in New York. That was why that happened. And I decided to go to New York because I decided that I would learn something either way, and I felt like I'd rather get paid even a tiny bit to learn something at a national magazine as an assistant than, you know, to be paying to go to grad school in San Francisco. So I did not get my MFA. Instead, I ended up at Entertainment Weekly.
Did you ever go back to school?
I did not.
And so how did it happen? I mean, you know, get more specific. So you went to Entertainment Weekly on your, you know, like an interview. What happened there?
I came to New York and actually worked at, there was a brief time that felt very long when I worked at a mall because I didn't have a job when I came to New York. And, I mean, everybody kept telling me you have to be here to get, you know, to get a job here. Nobody's going to hire you from across the country. And that's really true. Too many people want to be in media in New York for them to bother looking at a resume with, you know, a Chicago address on it. So I just moved, and I was lucky because he had gotten a job. So, you know, I was able, like, we got a place, and he was employed, so we could survive. And so I came there, I was working at a mall in New Jersey for a little while. We lived in New Jersey in a condo and, you know, kind of was trying anything I could. I got a temp job at Condé Nast, which is the magazine company that publishes, you know, Vogue and Glamour and The New Yorker and that kind of thing. I was just helping them. This is actually really funny because it was 2001. I was helping them put print stuff that they had in their archive onto the internet. That was like my whole job. We were scanning them in and I had to proofread the stuff and because it would come out a lot of gibberish some of the time.
Right.
And so I was like checking it. While I was doing that, I was sending my resumes everywhere. And, you know, it was, I mean, I think every magazine company in town had my resume at some point, and I had gone in on many interviews and actually ended up going through, I can't believe this, but I actually had an interview at, like, the human resources department at Time Inc., which I never think is a good way to go into. You know, I think you should find a person. But I was lucky and had this interview, and they asked me, where would you like, you know, which of our magazines is your dream job? And I said, you know, I would work at Teen People. I remember that. I said, I wouldn't mind working at Teen People. This is a weird combination, real simple, because I had been in home decor, so I thought maybe throw that one in there. And Entertainment Weekly was my actual dream job, and I had told my college advisor that. I remember telling him that when I was in college. So I was like, my actual dream job here is my dream job, which is Entertainment Weekly. And they had an opening a few weeks later for an assistant. So, I mean, it took many, many rounds of interviews after that, but I got that job. And I will say, you know, to the kids listening, that when I got hired, actually, when I got hired, my boss, this is amazing, my first job when I got hired was to send the rejection letters to everybody who didn't get my job. Which I love that he did that. And I said, you know, I asked him, like, God, I see all these people with their, you know, fancy master's degrees from Columbia and everything. Why did you pick me? And he said it was because I had been a newspaper reporter. And they felt like they could teach me to the entertainment industry, and they could give me the contacts there, but they couldn't teach somebody to report if they didn't know how to report. And that was so rare. You know, they were getting these, like, straight out of journalism school, or like from, they were people coming from other fancy magazine jobs, and they were like, we love that we can send you like anywhere, and you know how to like look up court documents or call the police or do what you need to do. So that turned out to pay off in some way.
Well, you had worked in a paper, you said, in Southern California. What paper was that?
I worked at several, because those are weird, brief jobs in some ways. But the main one I worked at was called the Daily Pilot. I believe it still exists, actually. One of the rare local papers that might still sort of exist in some fashion. Very small. I can't remember the circulation. I want to say something like 10,000. I'm not sure. But it was a really, actually, weirdly powerful local paper, because it includes two cities, Newport Beach and Costa Mesa. But Newport Beach is one of the wealthiest cities in the nation. It's a beach, you know, it's on the beach, huge, you know, waterfront mansions. And this is where, if anybody watched The O.C., this was the setting for The O.C., very, very rich people. And so that was what I did. I covered rich people's city government. And the thing is that rich people like property values a lot. And so they're actually, and they're very entitled, so they're extremely interested in their local news, and they're pretty vocal about anything they don't like. They will show up at the city. You know, there was a big controversy once. There were so many, but one of my favorites is that they got a new Mercedes-Benz dealership, and they put it right on the bay, and they hadn't thought about the fact that the lights from the Mercedes-Benz dealership were going to reflect off the bay into people's million-dollar homes. And the owners of the million-dollar homes did not care for this at all. So weeks and probably months of controversy and meetings and, like, measuring light levels and how are we going to fix this, that was the kind of thing that went on. And so it was a very, very closely read newspaper. And we competed with the Orange County Register and the Los Angeles Times. So that was when I would be, you know, getting up every morning and, you know, looking at the other papers and seeing if I wanted to throw up because they had gotten a story that I missed. We were expected to, you know, not be maybe the best writers because we were competing with bigger papers, but we were expected to get them first because we were plugged in. So that was my early 20s.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking today with television historian Jennifer Cation Armstrong. Her new book is called Sex and the City and Us, How Four Single Women Changed the Way We Think, Live, and Love. Before the break, Jennifer Cation Armstrong, you were talking about your training working for newspapers, and then you got a job at Entertainment Weekly. What was your first byline there?
That's so weird. At first I was going to say I don't know, but I think I do, which is something, I don't remember the specifics, but there was something about, like, smoking on television. It was tiny. It was like a sidebar or something else where I had to do, like, mm-hmm. something about the history of smoking on television, which actually sounds kind of cool. I can find that.
Since you could be your next book. Could be your next book.
Yeah, I might revisit that. That seems kind of fun. Because it was sort of like a big deal, and there was a while where people were like supposed to not, you know, it was like not cool to smoke on television because the kids would want to do it. But then Mad Men and shows like that kind of brought it back. But my first, like, I definitely know my first big feature story was on The OC, strangely enough. probably not strangely enough. I was obsessed with that show from the beginning because of my experience with Newport Beach, and they said that was my first one where they sent me out to Los Angeles, and that was a really big deal. Got to stay at Shutters on the Beach and everything. And my first cover story was Nick Lachey and Jessica Simpson's reality show, Newlyweds.
So you got paid to watch a lot of television.
I really did. I still do to some extent. That was sort of what happened is, you know, when you're at Entertainment Weekly, I was the news and notes assistant, which was like, that's the front section. It doesn't exist anymore, but it was the front section of the magazine where it was what it sounds like, you know, kind of newsy stuff. But I eventually moved to TV and I was a TV assistant and then moved up from there. And you kind of have to pick a major. It's just too hard to know enough. You know, you have to know a lot about your genre if this is what you write about. So I found it really difficult to keep up enough on pop music and movies. And, you know, it was kind of like TV, I can just concentrate and know it really well. So that was where I ended up. I would have loved any of them, but that was where I sort of ended up and obviously have made my career since then on television.
When you were a little girl, did your parents say, turn off that television?
My parents did not, but that's only because they watch tons of television. I notice it now when I'm with my mom. She watches, she kind of just always has it on, and I think my dad used to do that too. But I do, like, I was a TV nerd even when I was a kid. Like, the thing I always talk about, and it really is true, is I would get, when we used to get the TV guide, you know, when you'd actually get that in the mail.
Oh, yeah.
I would read all the articles. And then I would go to the pages in the middle that had, like, the grids where it showed you, you know, the schedules for each night. And I would, like, go through and then circle all the things I was going to watch. So I was pretty intense even then. And I was always a pop culture completist. I did the same thing with I love pop music. And, like, if I decided, you know, like, I loved George Michael. I didn't just love George Michael. I went and made sure I got every single thing he had ever recorded. I went to the library and, like, read everything about him. This was just the way I was a nerd. This was the way I consumed my pop culture all the time.
It sounds very familiar. Now, I know when you were working at Entertainment Weekly that you covered Donald Trump.
Yes, sure did.
they put you there because nobody else wanted to cover that show.
Yeah, that's true. It's actually true. And I mean, it's not because I was psychic and knew, you know, the monster he was going to become, but it was just more like, you know, it was the beginning of reality television. And while Survivor had already been going for a while and like was sort of respected-ish, and certainly at EW, like they were big Survivor fans, but there was still this great skepticism about the rest of reality television. And so I covered a lot of early reality TV because nobody else wanted to go to these things. So I did America's Next Top Model and The Apprentice, among others. And so I was there, you know, at the first, like, press event they had for The Apprentice. And I want to say they, like, flew Donald Trump in on a helicopter, of course. And it was at Trump Tower, of course. And I met Omarosa and all of the other contestants. And, yeah, nobody else wanted to cover it. And then it was, I mean, people forget this, but it really was a huge hit for a little while. And that was one of my cover stories. I did a cover story on that. And I used to talk to Donald all the time, actually, because this might not surprise anyone. But he was really good for a quote. And so, you know, I remember there would just be times where, I mean, almost anything, and we just sort of, they'd be like, call Donald Trump, he'll say something about that, you know, and so it's weird, but for a little while, I mean, I don't think he'd remember me now, but there was like a time in life when I and Donald Trump were familiar with each other. and we talked often. I knew his secretary. I would go to his office sometimes. It's very, very strange to me that that man became president. That's all I can say.
And were you ever alone with him?
Yeah. I have one clear memory, and it was because of, this was like when we did a cover story. So I really spent a good like hour plus with him in his office to do that. And, you know, I mean, he did not actually sexually harass me or anything like that. Borderline like Donald Trumpy things, like he'd tell me I was beautiful and stuff, which is just normal Donald Trump stuff. Had this weird like conversation with his daughter on the phone in front of me, and he said, you know, I have to go now, darling. There's a young woman almost as beautiful as you are in the office right now, and I have to go talk to her. That's, you know, not great, but wasn't as bad as the things that some other people experienced with him. And the one thing I really remember about him, and all, like, this was this interaction, but many, which is that he would just lie to my face constantly. But it was, like, about ratings and stuff like that. So I didn't feel like I had to, like, call him out on it and challenge him. I mean, I would sometimes be like, that's not really true or whatever. But it was mostly, like, he'd be like, well, as you know, we're the number one show of all time. And I would be like, well, that's not really true, but okay, sure, carry on. You know what I mean? Like, it was that kind of... And then we would just say in this, it was sort of a joke in the story. We'd like quote him and then say like, that's not true. It's actually this. but I say it all the time, but of all the people that I interviewed during my time at EW, I mean, I know he was always making noises about running for president, but I really didn't believe it would happen. And I would, couldn't we just like have Patrick Dempsey or somebody instead of someone else that I interviewed, while I was at EW, I can think of many I would prefer. but here we are, and that is the world we live in now, is that I do think it's made it very interesting. Like, he's brought this different... It's like, I keep saying everything matters now. It's like, you can't just say to yourself, like, oh, that's dumb pop culture. Like, who cares about Omarosa? Like, well, Omarosa spent time in the White House. So, unfortunately, she kind of matters now whether you want her to or not. Or, like, Kanye West going to the White House and Kid Rock going to the White House. It's just, like, a free-for-all at this point.
It's like the Entertainment Weekly merged with the Wall Street Journal.
It's really, actually, it's funny because that reminds me of one of my favorite anecdotes, which is, you know, people, there's certain snotty writing people who like to look down on the kind of work that I and many of my colleagues do. And I once went, years ago, went to a Paris Review party. I mean, I was asking for it, right? I was at a Paris Review party. But somebody asked me what I did. This guy asked me what I did. And I said I was a writer at Entertainment Weekly. And in fact, I had to go soon because, unfortunately, I had to recap Grey's Anatomy that night. And so I said, you know, when I said I work at Entertainment Weekly, he said, he kind of sarcastically, this was several election cycles ago, and he sarcastically said, like, oh, who are you guys endorsing for president? And that's pretty funny now. I think if we had endorsed someone, or at least if anyone had asked Entertainment Weekly if we thought Donald Trump should be president, I think we could have easily said absolutely not, because we actually know the man. Nothing he has done has surprised me. I did not trust that man when I knew him, and I do not trust him now. So, you know, all bets are off at this point.
What do you think is more unlikely, that Donald Trump would be president or that Grey's Anatomy would still be on the air?
I actually would have put my money on Grey's, which I guess I would have been right about that too. It's incredible that shows. Still go. I want to say 17 years now. It's something like that.
It's in its 35th season of Grey's Anatomy.
That's another one that I did a lot of reporting on. That was a huge part of my life at EW, and it was like during the, you know, when it was a huge hit, huge. I was there constantly. I was on the set of Grey's Anatomy. Like, I mean, and it was in LA, and I was in New York, but they were constantly flying me out to the set of Grey's Anatomy, like, to the point where Patrick Dempsey once said to me something like, why are you here again? I have no more things I can tell you. I've told you everything. I was like, because people still want to see your picture on the front of our magazine, I'm going to sit here and write down more things you say. It's just the way it goes right now.
So when you were at Entertainment Weekly, having been a fangirl of sorts of music and movies and television, who did you get to meet that was like a thrill?
That's a good question. I got so used to it. I know that sounds like, you know, snotty or something. But, you know, I would actually in a weird way say it was more like early on, and it wasn't like the big interviews that I did. Very early, I did a lot of red carpet reporting, which is terrible. It's a terrible experience. It's just like you're just like roped off like cattle, and you're supposed to yell at celebrities, which I won't do, so I was terrible at it. but I met just an unbelievable succession of people very quickly, and it was almost like desensitization therapy or something. I think it was really good for me in retrospect, because it was just like, here's Paul Newman, here's Tom Hanks, here's Catherine Zeta-Jones, over. Yeah, it was just like one after another. I did cover a lot of these giant premieres at the time, and it was when movies were still a thing, you know? Like, I remember, like, I covered the Chicago premiere. I covered the Road to Perdition premiere. I covered the premiere to that M. Night Shyamalan movie Signs. I did a lot of them. And so these were very, very big stars from my time, you know what I mean? From my youth. And so that was big. And then, like, there's also just silly things. Like, I can remember talking to Rob Lowe on the phone, and it was one of the few times, it was still pretty early, and I just almost had, like, a panic attack, because I was like, like, I suddenly let myself think Rob Lowe is on the phone, and I sort of, like, had an out-of-body experience for a minute, and then I, like, brought it back in time. And then there's also, like, silly things, like, I remember getting to talk to George Knight from New Kids on the Block, and, like, the 12-year-old me actually would not survive hearing that news. Like, there's no way she could handle that. And the fact that I was just, like, you know, shooting the breeze on the phone with Jordan Knight and, like, you know, having a normal conversation was sort of thrilling. The rest of them, I think what it is that I didn't, you know, so many of these, like Grey's Anatomy, you know, it was exciting for me to meet Patrick Dempsey and talk to him a lot because I had been a fan of Can't Buy Me Love back in the day, the movie from the 80s. But most of those people, like a lot of the people that I met and talked to, it wasn't like they were my idols growing up. It was like they were just becoming famous at the time that I was talking to them. So like a Sandra Oh, or somebody like that, love her and felt like it was such a privilege to get to talk to her, but they were coming up too. And so it was a little, you know, spending time on the set of Lost. Like all those guys were just kind of becoming famous because of Lost. So it felt different in some ways, and I don't know, like I never talked to like a Madonna or something, and I honestly am still not sure I could handle that.
So you left Entertainment Weekly and started writing books. Mm-hmm. Was that because you decided it's time to leave Entertainment Weekly?
That's part of it. I was there for 10 years. That was the longest I ever had a job. And while, I mean, I've been talking about it and like, it sounds amazing, and it was my dream job, but it was kind of that thing where you go like, okay, I did my dream job, now what? And it was, you know, we had a lot of cutbacks at that time. Magazines kind of were on the downswing, and they still are. More internet, you know, it was like more space to fill, infinite space to fill, and no people to do it. So it could become a little bit of a grind, and kind of back to what I was saying about being a newspaper reporter, it's like, I didn't really get into this to write fast things. Or, you know, I wanted to, like, I like to dig in and really write. I got into it to write. And so I'd like to think for 2 seconds before I write something. And that was, it was bad, and just, like, I didn't want to be kind of quote-unquote breaking news about the next plot line on Grey's Anatomy. Like, that was not my idea. It's not even my idea of news. So it's kind of weird, like, that I was trying to chase down what was going to happen to imaginary people felt really weird. So I sort of got tired, and I always wanted to write books. That was my actual like big time dream. when I was growing up, and ended up, like, I had written a novel that didn't get published, and then I was approached by an agent who had read something I'd written. Actually, she had read an essay I wrote about my ending my engagement, as we were talking about earlier, and she was like, if you have any ideas, let me know. I'd love to represent you. And then she ended up bringing a project to me, which was that a publisher, Grand Central, was looking for someone to write a book about the 1950s Mickey Mouse Club. Now, I am not old enough to have been around for that, but I was very ambitious and wanted to write books, and this is a huge publisher. So I was like, I will figure that out. I will figure out what on earth went on with the 1950s Mickey Mouse Club, and let's do this. So that was my first book, and it was a surprise. You know, like, it was something that was somebody else's idea. But once I did that, it was really hard to write that book while on staff at EW. But once I did that, I was like, well, now that was cool, but what if I did a book about a show I actually cared about? Like, it hadn't occurred to me that you could pick a TV show and kind of write a biography of it. So they really gave me that idea, essentially. And I don't think that I figured out the right way to do it, at least until Mary and Lou. But that was how Mary and Lou and Rhoda and Ted was born, is I was like, all right, I want to do this full time. I'm going to write a proposal for a book like this, but about a show I love, and that's going to be the Mary Tyler Moore Show. And so I wrote that proposal, actually, and ended up having to get a new agent for that, and she sold it to Simon & Schuster, and I was able to quit my job.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro, and we're talking this week with Jennifer Cation Armstrong. She's the New York Times bestselling author of Seinfeldia and her new book, Sex and the City and Us, How Four Single Women Changed the Way We Think, Live, and Love. Well, now, your Mary Tyler Moore book was, and I love it, but and it was great.
Thank you.
And it was really about, you know, it really was a biography of that show. But then when you got to your Seinfeldia book, that was really not just a biography of the show, but also the impact that the show had right up until the time that you were writing the book. And I think you have that going on even more so with your new book, because as we've been talking about, you know, you're in it. So how have you refined your style?
That is a huge part of it. And part of it is, like, you know, a necessity. A necessity is the mother of invention thing. To me, like, the big, like, I'm always interested in how did the show actually have an effect? Because, like, I like a lot of shows, but they didn't have a huge effect on life. And so I don't really want to write about them. It's just my personal thing. And so the Mary Tyler Moore Show, it was more like that was about the women's movement of the 1970s, right? So I had some stuff about how feminists reacted, but I felt like the biggest impact was the fact that it had multiple women behind the scenes writing for the show, and then they were able to go out and, like, affect the rest of the entertainment industry. So it was really about them. And then when I looked at Seinfeld, it was like, what is the effect of the show? It's different. It's about, I mean, it's definitely about how it affected TV, but it's also about, you know, people are still quoting this thing, and they're, you know, the Brooklyn Cyclones minor league baseball team is still having an annual Seinfeld night, and it's 20 years later. Like, what is this actually about? To me, that was what was so interesting about the show, is that there's sort of a bunch of this stuff that makes sure that Seinfeld lives on. You know, the guy who plays the soup Nazi still makes his living playing the soup Nazi. Going around to conventions and saying no soup for you, and it thrills people. I'm very interested in fan behavior in general, because I think it's one of the, if you, like, were an alien and saw people acting this way, you'd be like, what's going on? It's just a really strange human behavior, and so I'm always interested in it, and Seinfeld really has that, and it, like you said, I was like, I had this idea of doing a complete history, which means including everything up until now. You know, it was really about its syndication and how it became more and more popular over time instead of less, and it didn't fade from memory. And Sex and the City is similar, but like I said, is more of a personal and lifestyle effect, I think. You know, it not only caused people to move to New York and cancel weddings, but also, you know, it created an entire cupcake industry that didn't exist. It made Manolo Blahnik's a household name throughout, you know, the country and the world, not just fashion circles. And so that, to me, was what, you know, that's, I'm always looking for kind of that, how did this affect actual regular people's lives, and how do they incorporate this show into their lives? And that's sort of what I was looking for with both Seinfeldia and Sex and the City and Us.
Also, you know, people have been talking for a long time about how The Sopranos really changed the landscape of television, but you kind of argue that it was Sex and the City just as much as The Sopranos.
Absolutely. And I, like, no, it's so funny how I always feel like I end up throwing shade at The Sopranos unnecessarily, because there's something, you just want to make that comparison, because they started within 6 months of each other on HBO, and HBO was built on both of them, really. And The Sopranos is phenomenal. But, yeah, Sex and the City was 6 months earlier. And if you think about what happened in TV comedy after Sex and the City, it has a big effect. You know, it's just as effective in terms of, like, our golden age of television, you know, switching us over to single camera comedies that are shot more like movies. You know, being able to, because of that, use different film effects and angles and all kinds of things. And also kind of, I mean, not that they're the only ones that did this, but I think they really brought in this era of comedies that are kind of serious and funny at times, like that they can be equally touching. And so something like Girls. So we have, honestly, it brought in this era of tremendous confusion in which, you know, now our Emmy categories are all screwed up because it's very confusing what's a comedy and what's a drama. And when you see some of the things that are competing against each other, it's like, well, that doesn't make any sense. But I like that because life has both comedy and drama in it. And so I love shows that can easily do that. And they really brought that in. And like I said, this sort of filmic approach and just building HBO into the thing that it is now. Like, it took so much for me in this book and in talking to groups about this book when I would find myself in front of mostly younger women, you know, millennial women, like, they really didn't know that HBO was not what HBO is then. You know, it was like boxing and movies that had already been at the movie theater. Like, that was what it was known for. And the fact, you know, it was a big deal that people sort of took a chance on bringing their show there and signing on to do this. So it really, you know, they built it.
Right. Home box office was what HBO was.
Right. It's so crazy. Like, it just was this whole different thing when I was growing up. It was not Game of Thrones and all of these things that it is now. It was just these, and then when they brought these shows in, I mean, it's kind of interesting to think about, really was just The Sopranos and Sex and the City, which are two very different shows. So let's go with that.
So now you're not going to do another biography of a TV show. You're going to do a biography.
We'll see. I'm working on some ideas that I hope I will know about soon.
So we're not ready to say.
Nope, not quite yet. This one's actually been like, I mean, I don't mind talking about it. Like, this next, trying to figure out the next project has been really hard. Because, I mean, I think I've done three really big shows. Other people are now doing TV books left and right. I didn't necessarily want the shows that people have taken, but, you know, there's two Friends books coming out. Well, one just came out, another's coming out next year. There's an Office book. There's, like, a lot of other people, you know, vying for this stuff now. But also, you kind of mentioned how I've refined this, but I also feel like it'd be cool to do something a little bit different. Like, I kind of got this now. Got this down. I'm not saying I definitely won't ever do a TV book again. I think it's a really cool approach. But it is harder and harder to pick shows that really live up to this. Not to mention that while there's tons of TV now, it's not like Seinfeld where, you know, tens of millions of people watch that show. Now if it's something's a hit, there's like 3 or 4 million who watch it.
Right,
so
that'll never happen again.
Thing.
Yeah, that'll never happen.
It's really hard to figure out. And granted, that all you need is a very enthusiastic fan base. You don't need, you know, tens of millions of people who watched it to write a book. But yeah, also just in terms of having the cultural impact we've been talking about, it gets harder and harder.
That's something that, you know, I mean, when we think about some of the shows, despite what Donald Trump said, that actually got, you know, incredibly huge ratings like Roots and so forth. I mean, that depended on a limited menu of things to do and watch, which is, you know, now unlimited.
Exactly. So even something like Mad Men, which did have an outsized cultural impact, I will say, but, you know, that had like 4 million viewers or something. I could be wrong, but it's not more than 10. It's in the single digits. And so it's just like a different, it's harder to find these things that, like, you know, really have this wide reaching impact. And even something like Game of Thrones, like, cool. And if somebody wants to write a book about that, I think that'd be great. But for me, when I'm looking for these shows that have like a personal impact on people, like, no one, I hope no one's going out and like living their lives like Game of Thrones. You know what I mean? Like, that's not,
that's right. It hasn't had that.
It can't have the same effect that, like, you know, a Seinfeld or a Sex and the City, which is more reality, you know, more grounded in reality, can have. It's just not, it's not the same. It's not like, oh, I'm going to go get a dragon or whatever because of Game of Thrones. So it's just, it's getting harder and harder to figure out those things. Plus, like I said, it'd be fun to, like, you know, stay in the realm of my expertise, but do something, just mix it up a little bit.
Well, this book is just marvelous. It's your best work. It's called Sex and the City and Us, How Four Single Women Changed the Way We Think, Live, and Love. And the author, my guest, Jennifer Cation Armstrong, thank you so much for letting me pry into your personal life.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.